I want to finish up the thought about this this meal served by the former L.A. County Health Inspector, where he said people could have physical, emotional, or aesthetic barriers?
Psychological. Yes. Medical. There could basically be no limit to what they were willing to consume.
Uh-huh. And so you attended this party, I'm getting?
I did. And what really was so interesting about it was how normal the other diners were. I mean, you would sort of think it would be the weirdest of the weird willing to sign up for this. And in fact, it was what stood as remarkable to me was how ordinary these people were. And this is it just proved to me that this has really become a mainstream movement. And it's also got intellectual underpinnings. This is a group of people that, even though they're excited for a thrilling food adventure, there's a sense of anxiety about the future that underlies these food adventures, in the sense that as Americans, we've got to start thinking outside of our meat and potatoes a little bit here.
So it's something more than the old Saturday Night Live joke about Scottish cuisine being based on a dare. It's more than a dare. There really is an environmental ethic and a sense of what you referred to already as necessity eating involved here.
There is. I think sometimes that gets lost in the sort of surface aspects of it, which can seem very macho or very almost gluttonous sometimes. But I think, to me, the more interesting and significant and lasting part of it is this drive behind it comes out of a concern with the way we have been eating and a desire to change that.
All right, so there are three sections to the book: Squishy or Swank, Down the Rabbit Hole, and Discomfort Food. Can you give us just a little thumbnail sketch of each of those sections?
Well,
I guess. What's the swank part?
The swank part is these tasting menus that are very, just incredibly elaborate and often quite expensive and sometimes served in very unofficial contexts. You know, the underground dinner, I think it's probably a big thing up where you guys are too. And the idea is that at this sort of leading edge of the food movement, which, you know, is sort of for the most elite diners in the world, there are ideas being presented in that context that are very much out of poverty eating, necessity eating. They really are not ways that Americans have ever been comfortable eating. We have had an idea that we're so advanced and civilized, and that's why we only eat the skeletal muscle of animals. And in fact, the people who are pushing the culture forward are saying, we need to eat lower on the animal, deeper in the animal, lower on the food chain. You know, the idea of foraging, the sort of survivalist aspect of these foods that, you know, a little bit of bark and lichen and an insect, and that's your $200 meal.
Wow. If that does happen, a bark and lichen and an insect is a $200 meal.
I've reduced it a little bit
okay.
to make a point, but you know, in the course of a 10-course meal, you might get any one of those or all of them.
All right, so there's a chapter here in the Squishy or Swank section on Jonathan Gold, the scavenger. You had a piece on him in the New Yorker, didn't you? I seem to remember this.
Yes,
this,
exactly.
This restaurant hopping thing. Okay, yeah, but let's shorten his list. Where doesn't he eat in L.A.?
Well, he's not so interested in anything that is trying to imitate a European model of dining. I mean, this is the advantage that L.A. has. It's never been considered a great food town, and it's so far away from Europe, and that kind of food has never really worked here. And what he has pointed out is the incredible diversity and just aesthetic pleasure to be had by seeking out little restaurants in, little traditional restaurants in the outskirts or in the little mini malls that people just drive past in their cars and don't notice, and because they don't read the language that the sign is in, they feel it almost blurs out to them and they don't go in. So he has really been the one pointing people into these spots and saying, look, here's where you can get, you know, the only Isan Thai restaurant in the entire, you know, Western United States is here. And and this is what you should order. And if you don't know what to order, just point. And he's opened up a lot of food to a lot of people who would otherwise never have encountered it.
Some of this stuff is too funny to believe, though. I mean, he did 27 shots of espresso in one day.
Well, he's the example. He's sort of the, you know, he's the Pied Piper of the foodies. He's getting people to eat raw liver and things like that. But he's also an example, I think, of this encyclopedic eating that seems to really be a feature of foodieism, which is to say, you know, this incredible thoroughness. And, of course, he's a restaurant critic, so there's some rationale for it. But what if you're just a blogger doing that, or you're but I think he's made that kind of approach to eating part of the foodie approach.
So you've got to do like the whole gamut of this particular category in one day or something.
Yes, and it's perfect for the kind of amateur experts that define the sort of popular food movement, and this is everybody with an Instagram or Twitter or blog account.
All right, so, and where do people read Jonathan Gold's stuff? His restaurant reviews.
Well, he's sort of bounced back and forth between the LA Times and the LA Weekly for years, but the columns that won him fame and earned him a Pulitzer Prize, and he's still the only food writer who's ever gotten one, were in the LA Weekly. But now he's at the LA Times.
He guzzled hot sauce as a kid, I understand. Is it possible his taste buds are just worn out?
You know, he can taste so many things in a fiery dish that I can't, that I think the answer is no. I think he has an incredibly refined palate. I think that he has tested it against almost every edible substance on Earth, and many that a lot of Americans wouldn't recognize as edible.
All right, I want to move on and talk about other people in this section on Squishy or Swank, particularly about the creation of the National Association for the Specialty Food Trade, the NASFT.
Yeah.
When did that start and why?
So this is where I explore the origins of the sort of daredevil eating or unconventional eating in America. And it turned out that they coincide with the origins of gourmet, which used to be called specialty food. So World War II, obviously, a lot of people came to this country as refugees before, during, and after World War II. And starting over, a group particularly of Jewish refugees became specialty food importers. But this had not really existed in this country before. And this group of entrepreneurs, they would go to Europe, they would go to Asia, they would go to Latin America, and they would seek out delicacies that were unfamiliar to Americans and present them as gourmet. So sometimes those were not gourmet items in other countries, because, you know, what's specialty is a matter of what's familiar or what's not familiar.
So the everyday for one country is the specialty for us.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the sort of spam in the French gourmet market idea, and that does happen. Or Uncle Ben's, that's an example I heard often, that you can go to the fanciest, up until the 80s, you could go to the fanciest French department store and see Uncle Ben's presented as a delicacy. But this group really took great risks, and there were a bunch of really fascinating swashbuckling characters who introduced, alongside with, you know, caviar and foie gras and French cheese, they introduced barbecued baby bees and Bengal tiger meat, and, you know, in those days Hawaiian punch was considered exotic, and and marinated artichokes and baby corn. So it's really interesting to see this specialty food industry in its infancy, and the way in which sort of these titillating, unfamiliar foods played into it from the very beginning.
Dana Goodyear is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, New Yorker staff writer, teacher at the University of Southern California, author of Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. The history lesson on getting what were then called specialty foods into America is really useful, because it makes us realize that there were things that our ancestors thought were icky, and yeah, I would never eat something like that. So the things that we say about that today could end up being the stuff our kids take for granted.
Well, that's true, and I do think that this group of young, you know, this sort of younger demographic that I'm talking about that so fully embraces the idea of being interested in food and has really made that part of social identity, when those people raise their kids, they're going to raise them with different attitudes from the way that maybe a lot of people in my generation or older were raised. So I think there is this sense that I see this as something that will become that's not a blip and not a trend, but it's going to be part of American identity in a very a much more profound way. I mean, we've been so, for the past 100 years in American culture, we've been really driving food to the margins. We don't know food producers. Food production happens in factories. It happens away from us. It's not something we do at home anymore. It's very abstract, and it has been very abstract. And a lot of this movement is about making it more literal again and bringing it back into daily life.
You use the term swashbuckler ready, which I guess is the answer to my question, which is how much salesmanship did it take in the 50s and 60s to get people to try unusual foods?
Well, that's part of my double entendre with the title, Anything That Moves, because I think there is, you know, food marketing is an enormous part of this, and how you present food, and do you call it ant eggs or do you call them escamoles, and which sounds more appetizing to you? So these salesmen really were incredibly influential, and they had a great audience, though, because, you know, it was, let's say, the 1950s. By this point, there were a lot of Americans who had been overseas during the war, who had traveled, who had been exposed to different things. They were also, there was a time of great prosperity in America. People had money to spend. They were showing off a little bit. They were moving out to the suburbs. They entertained at home, and they wanted to, you know, have those chocolate-covered ants to serve their bridge group. So there was a real, there was a drive for novelty then, and I think that has never left the specialty food category or the gourmet food category.
Right. Since we're in here talking about bugs, let's come back to the whole Eat a Bug cookbook and eating of insects discussion, because it was well represented in that conversation, that, and you just brought it up again, 80% of the world, pretty much everybody outside the United States, has bugs in their diet at some point or another. Does that include Europe, though? I mean, is Europe also, do they get past the ick factor on bugs?
They do in certain contexts, but not generally, not as a, you know, something to see on your plate as a bug. I mean, there are European cheeses that can't be made, you know, Mimolet, or, you know, can't be made without insects that remain in the cheese. So I think that there are very specific contexts in which it's okay for Europeans, but in general, Anglo and European, you know, I'll just say Western, very broadly, culture has not been very accepting of bugs. But that's just because we don't have a culinary tradition built up around them. We don't have the recipes from our grandmother. We don't have the positive associations of, you know, your birthday cricket.
Oh, right, yeah. The grasshoppers grandma used to make. Yeah.
We have the opposite. We have, you know, people growing up with good reason being told, don't eat that, don't put a bug in your mouth. But and it is not safe to wild craft or forage for your own insects, because you don't know, you know, we have a lot of pesticides in the soil, and you don't know where they've been. So there, you have to make sure you're getting clean bugs the same way, you know, with any animal.
That was a real light bulb moment in the book for me, though, when you pointed out, though, that part of the reason that we use so many pesticides is because we don't want, not only do we not eat bugs, we don't want bugs in our other foods.
Exactly. It is ironic, and you know, there's been such a drive to eliminate bugs, and we think of them as pests, and we haven't appreciated them as protein sources. And you know, what is happening now is that a vanguard of chefs is starting to say these are protein sources.
They really are. And in fact, one of the things that we learned from the author of the Eat a Bug cookbook was that the ratio of fat to protein is just so much better. I mean, by weight, you just get much more out of bugs, actually, than you get for much less resource put into it, you know, much less in the way of water and corn and all the other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, if you're expecting to eat the equivalent of a 12-ounce steak, you're going to have to eat a pile of 1,000 insects. But I think that the corresponding idea that could make people more open to it is that we don't need as much protein as we've been telling ourselves we need. So we overeat protein in a pretty obscene way in this country, and that has that drive to have meat on the table every day has influenced our, you know, our environmental practices in so many negative ways. So I think that there is, even among the most meat-centric chefs that I have spent time with, there's a sense that, you know what, meat needs to move to the edge of the plate. Something else needs to be in the center.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, it makes you stop and think about just the way we allocate land, even because of the way we eat.
Yeah.
Everything is just very, very dependent upon what we put on the plate in the first place. There's a long section in the book about food in Las Vegas, which gets into some things that are illegal, not uniformly so, which makes the rest of us always wonder, what is the appeal of shark fin soup? It sounds like it's not particularly tasty.
Shark fin soup is a status symbol. So it is an unsustainable idea of, you know, the sort of emperor's food that has become a marker of middle class prosperity. So the the regulations in California to eliminate it have everything to do with the fact that, you know, there's a booming middle class and in Chinese culture and in China, but also in this country. I mean, that, you know, California can't influence anything but California consumption patterns, but they're just, you know, the depletion of the shark population worldwide is really tragic and has consequences for the rest of the marine ecosystem. So, the way that the shark fins are gotten is pretty cruel, and it's also pretty wasteful. And because the fins are valuable, but the rest of the shark isn't, they're definned, and then the shark is left to drown, basically, or bleed out, and dumped in the ocean, so that, you know, the more valuable, there's more room for the more valuable fins on board the ship. So, that's one of those cases where broader sense of what's edible. Americans don't usually think about eating a shark fin. A broader sense of what's edible has some built-in problems there.
That is interesting, too, because the fact is the rest of the shark is eminently edible, but that is not the choice that's made when you're making shark fin soup.
Exactly.
All right. I want to get another great life story in here. Brett Ottolenghi, you go on at length in the book. When did he begin selling truffles? He was pretty young, wasn't he?
Well, I call him the truffle kid because he started when he was 13 out of his dorm room. He went to a boarding school in the Northeast, and became a purveyor of Croatian truffles out of his dorm room.
You're going to sell things out of your dorm room, that's one of the good ones.
Exactly.
Let's take a break there and come back
talk
more about Brett Ottolenghi. Dana Goodyear is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture.